Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Rene Lamirez, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Kamchatka, trout fishing's next frontier. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're going to broadcast live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Rene a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you are there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to the website at your convenience and listen to this broadcast at any time. Content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Rene Lamirez about Kamchatka, trout fishing's next frontier. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. Before we introduce Rene, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and also a 1-year membership to Fly Fusion Magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Rene's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, and we'll fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Rene's book, Alaska Fishing, The Ultimate Guide to Ultimate Cold Water Sport Fishing Destination. Compliments of Rene, of course. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talked about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills to be a winner. Our guest tonight is Rene Lamirez. Rene has been involved in Alaska fly fishing for almost 25 years. Originally from the East Coast, he came up to Alaska in the late 70s to pursue a guiding and outdoors writing career. Since then, Rene has led hundreds of fishing trips across the remoteness of southwest Alaska and Russia's Far East. His articles and photographs have appeared in all the major sporting magazines. He has given seminars on fly fishing Alaska and Russia at sports shows, universities, fly clubs, and other venues. And as editor and publisher of Alaska Fishing, The Ultimate Angler's Guide, third edition, he has created what many consider to be the Alaska Fishing Bible. Rene Lamirez currently resides with his family just north of Anchorage, Alaska, and is the owner-operator of Ultimate Rivers, offering the ultimate in wilderness cold water angling adventures in Alaska, Kamchatka, Russian and the Far East mainland for rainbow trout, steelhead, salmon, char, and Siberian taimen. Rene, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Hello, Roger, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, good. Good to have you. And I say welcome back because we had Rene on the show once before, and we did a show with him on Siberian taimen, which is a very unusual sport fish that many people have not been introduced to or know about even, and that was a great show. And if you'd like to listen in on Rene's show on that, you can go to our archives and look up Siberian taimen and listen in on that show and get enlightened about how to fish for taimen. Well, tonight, though, we'll be talking, Rene, about Kamchatka. And Kamchatka, I know, is a love of yours and a place you've been going for many years. Why don't, first of all, to just kind of clue people in on where it is in the world, tell us its geographic details and how we might find it and how we might get there.
Well, Kamchatka, it's a part of Russia. It's a part of the Russian Far East. And basically, it's located west and south of Alaska. It's a peninsular extension of Asia. And if you take a map and just of Alaska and follow the sweep of the Aleutian Islands, it almost comes almost very close to touching the last of the Aleutian Islands. And the eastern coast of the Kamchatka Peninsula is about 1,500 miles as a crow flies south and west from Anchorage.
Okay. Now, how big is Kamchatka in comparison to something
it's
that can
it's relate a irregular shape, like kind of shaped like a pointed finger. And at its widest, it's about maybe 300 miles wide, and it's about 700 or so miles long, and it's roughly the same area as the state of Nevada.
Okay, okay. And is it truly frontier, or is it well-populated? What kind of give us a picture of...
Yeah, well, you know, for the longest time, Kamchatka was pretty much off-limits, even to Russians. It was it had a strategic importance as a submarine base during the Cold War years, and so for the most part, most of the population was centered around that military base there in the southeast coast around the city of Petropavlovsk, and there were some scattered villages up and down the coast. But its population is about 330,000 people, most of them living around the main port and hub of Petropavlovsk. So essentially, most of the peninsula is totally remote and unpopulated. When you say frontier, of course, that's all relative, but compared to, let's say, Alaska or some of these other places that have comparable trout fishing, Kamchatka represents a state of development of, let's say, 50 years or more ago. So it's essentially very much a frontier, in my opinion.
Can you get to, are there roads coming from mainland Russia to Kamchatka, or can you only get there by boat or plane?
Yeah, no, it's isolated, and the only way to access it is from the air, from the sea. There's no roads leading to mainland.
Interesting. Boy, from Russia's standpoint, it must have been very isolated as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, because Siberia isn't probably... vacation destination for a lot of Russians either over the years.
No, it was more a work destination. In fact, you know, at the time that they settled most of Siberia, they gave people some really attractive incentives to settle in Siberia. And that was one of the main reasons, aside from the great, the higher level of pay and other benefits, they gave people bonuses for settling in places like Kamchatka, and that's how those areas were settled.
Kind of like working in the oil fields of Alaska or the crab fishing in Alaska or something.
Yeah, huh? Even more so, because these were government incentives, whereas, obviously in our country, we the incentives have to come from the private industries to lure people up, workers up. But, in Russia, most of Siberia was settled. Well, I should say, backtrack a little bit, that a lot of Siberia was settled by forced labor because... There was a place where they had gulags and everything, but for people who went there voluntarily, they were enticed by some real attractive incentives from the government.
Well, the people of Kamchatka specifically, do you find there are generations and generations of the same families there?
A lot of people, have been only there for, maybe one or two generations and were... It came up there, during the Cold War years or after World War II. And then you have a resident population of natives, which is a small percentage. Like, say, in Kamchatka, represents a small percentage. I believe the native population is maybe 30,000 or less. So, for the most part, Russians from other parts of the country have settled there in the last generation or so.
When you say natives, are they similar to natives in Alaska?
Yeah, correct. They're basically the same ethnic origin and different tribes or different sects, so to speak, of people who either live by reindeer herding or live off the marine mammals along the coast and fish and stuff.
Okay, whaling and sea lions and seals and
so
forth. Yeah. Now, what? Speaking of wildlife, what kind of wildlife might you encounter on Kamchatka? Is it similar to Alaska?
Yeah, very similar. A brown bear's healthy brown bear population is bigger. Each bear, bears is bigger, not bigger than those found on in southwest Alaska or on the Alaska Peninsula. And wolves, moose, caribou, there's reindeer, waterfowl. There, you know, obviously as part of Asia, then you have some unique, some exotic species that aren't found in Alaska, like the Steller Sea Eagle and some waterfowl that's not found over here. So there's everything, you know, many of the animals found in Alaska, but then there's also some exotics as well.
Did you say caribou, too? Or
a caribou, yes. And also stone sheep in the mountains.
Stone sheep. So is that like a bighorn?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A unique species found basically unique to Northeast Asia,
mm-hmm.
the mountains
okay.
of Northeast Asia.
Okay, so yeah, and fishing over there, you'd have a similar experience of enjoying.
Fishing. You've got the Pacific salmon. You've got an additional species of cherry or masu salmon. So you've got six. You've got six species of salmon. Rainbow trout, of course. Dolly Varden char, and there's also a species of char not found over here, the East Siberian char. There's grayling. So essentially, real similar to in species mix in the rivers there to what we have here in Alaska.
What is the landscape of Kamchatka look like? Can you give kind of a visual?
It's similar to Alaska. Very rugged. There's a spine of mountains that runs up through the center of the peninsula, and basically divides the peninsula in half in terms of the drainages. You know, either east flowing or west flowing. Very lush. It reminds me. I tell people it's like South Central Alaska on steroids. It has very, very exuberant, lush growth of vegetation during the summer, with beautiful meadows of wildflowers and really, in some areas, almost impenetrable thickets of vegetation because this grows so thick. And it's got a tremendous number of volcanoes. It has probably the greatest concentration of active volcanoes of any place in the world. There's over 30 active volcanoes there, and there's many more that are dormant, and hot springs and geysers, and just a very geothermal active area. So it's unique. It's very scenic. It's just as beautiful as Alaska, with a little bit more geothermal activity, and just, you know, slightly different because of the fact that it lies roughly the same latitude as British Columbia, and it sits out in the Pacific. So it's got a kind of a unique mix of climate that produces its own kind of vegetation and stuff. So it's very a beautiful place.
And folks, just for your reference, on Renee's speakers page, which you can get to from either his name on our homepage or the Learn More About Renee link, we did put links to two maps that are also on Renee's website. One is the Alaska-Kamchatka map, which kind of shows you in relationship where Alaska and Kamchatka are to one another. And then we also have a map that he supplied as well to Kamchatka specifically. And we can talk more about that as we get into this, about the areas and so forth there. But just so that you have a reference point and can look at something, check out those maps as you're listening, and that'll help you out. When we're going over to the fly fish, do you fish primarily streams, rivers, lakes?
Most of the fishing is done in streams and rivers. There are some lake and river systems. Most of them are found along the East Coast. But almost all the operators that fish over there have programs that involve streams and rivers. And so basically it differs from trout fishing in other places like, say, New Zealand and even Alaska to some extent.
Okay. Now, these streams and rivers, are they big or small by Alaskan standards or West?
Well, compared to mainland Alaska, most of the streams in Kamchatka would be considered small to medium-sized streams, nowhere near the size of some of the larger mainland rivers in Alaska. And most of them are runoff or spring-fed, so it's all clear water fishing. And most of the streams that are featured by the people in business over there, it's all weight and cast fishing. So the streams are weightable, and it's sight fishing for big trout. And it's that's one of the draws of Kamchatka, is the near-perfect stream conditions for fly fishing.
Clear and big fish.
Yeah, right.
Scott in Denver, Colorado, wants to know, since you just brought up one of the highlights of fishing there. But what are the highlights of fishing in Kamchatka, and what are the low points as well?
Well, the highlight is obviously that you're getting the fish in a totally virgin area. The number of rivers that have been fished so far by mostly operators is only a small percentage of the total rivers on Kamchatka. So essentially, there's still a lot of unexplored territory over there. So with not too much difficulty, you can fish rivers and streams that essentially have not been fished by Western anglers. And of course, that's becoming increasingly more of a precious commodity in this world. I mean, people have been up here to Alaska in the last 5 or 10 years will know that most of the better streams in our state here are getting, you know, more and more pressure every year. It's getting harder and harder to find streams that don't have lots of people on them. So that's the high point. It's basically one of the last places where you can fish streams for big trout that are not seeing other people and basically enjoy virgin fishing conditions. As far as the low points, it's the bittersweet realization while you're over there that this isn't going to last very long. And that's about the only low point I can think of. And also the expense of getting over there and fishing and stuff.
Right, right. It is kind of
far
away and removed. And, relating to stories in Alaska, it doesn't take that many years to change an area. I mean, I know when I lived in Alaska in the 60s, we drove up there, and we drove up to Alaska on Alkane Highway, which is all gravel, and that kept a lot of tourists away. And it was quite the adventure for us as a family. And then we used to fish at Bird Creek just outside of Anchorage. I think that's about 40 minutes away or something like that. And my dad and I would be the only two people on that river. And we went up there about 4 years ago, and there's wall-to-wall, shoulder-to-shoulder people fishing that river.
Right.
So in my lifetime, I've seen a tremendous change. In fact, we used to fish in, Ship Creek, right in downtown, and used to do really well right in downtown Anchorage. I don't know what that's like now, but.
No, it's a pretty, it's a mad combat scene now.
Yeah, I bet. But I know things have changed there, and it's only inevitable that the world will catch up with Kamchatka as well. So, like you say, take advantage of the opportunity now. Well, I assume that's we had another question here. Why fish Kamchatka instead of Alaska, being that they are similar in many respects? You just mentioned one of them is the seclusion and the isolation, if you like that kind of fishing. Are there other reasons that you might want to go there instead of Alaska?
Yeah, well, obviously the big, like you said, the big draw is the fact that it's like Alaska was 50 years ago. But another reason to fish over there, especially if you can take advantage of some of the longer trips that are offered by some of the operators, is a chance to interact with the Russian culture and to meet new friends and just experience an exotic culture and also catch some species that aren't found over here, and just a chance to spread goodwill. And the trip is a lot more than just fishing, so that's what I'd like to stress to my clients.
Well, I'm sure that the people that live there are probably much different than the Western Russians and the people of Moscow and so forth. The fact of where they're living, and they're not, city people per se, and probably very interesting. And how do most of the local people make a living? What's the major industries there?
One of the major industries is fishing, commercial fishing, out in the North Pacific. Very rich fishing grounds out there. Of course, government employs a significant sector of the public and government jobs, government-related jobs. Tourism is growing. There's a little bit of industry, not much, and agriculture. It's a very, it's a very similar mix to the job scene up in Alaska. Not as much oil, of course, but mining is becoming more and more important as well. So very similar to Alaska in the way people are employed.
Well, when was the first time that you fished in Kamchatka, and how have you seen a change over those years?
Oh yeah, we were involved in and I think I discussed this in the Timon broadcast, that we got involved in some of the first sport fishing trips over to Russia as as Glasnost took on more and more people, obviously barriers came down and more people and groups were allowed into Russia back in the late 80s. And so we got involved with the Timon fishing program in different parts of Siberia, and then we settled on a program fishing out of Khabarovsk, which is along the coast there near the lower Amur River. And it was just a natural jump then from Khabarovsk to Kamchatka. As Kamchatka opened up in the early 90s, they lifted restrictions on travel to Kamchatka. Through our contacts in Khabarovsk, we were put in touch with people who were real anxious to develop tourism to Kamchatka. And we had heard rumors about the trout fishing. So we went over in the early 90s and did some exploratory trips and were real amazed at just the potential for fishing and doing the kind of trips that we do, which are essentially float fishing trips. You know, the rivers are ideally perfectly suited for that. So we just started just doing trips over there and developing our ties with our contacts and the people that we were doing business with. And essentially, we were there from the ground level up. And the changes I've seen are not just changes to Kamchatka, but changes throughout much of Russia as they've come online with a market economy and developed their infrastructure. And it's real interesting to see how they've developed it. Not at all like you think it would be in certain respects, but in a lot of respects it is similar to what you would expect. But it's been interesting.
Well, we need to take a little break, but I'd like to come back and explore that a little bit more with you. So when we return, we'll be talking with Renee more about fly fishing in Kamchatka. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado, located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Renee Lamares about Kamchatka, trout fishing's next frontier. If you'd like to ask Renee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Renee, when you first, I'm just curious, the first trip, the first flight you took over there to Kamchatka to go fishing and test out these fine trout waters, did you take your own rafts? Did you bring all your own equipment? What was it like that first trip?
The first trips were, not as adventurous or as risky as you might have thought, because we had all the gear based in Khabarovsk, and Khabarovsk is just basically a hop away on the mainland. So basically what we did was we shipped gear on the airlines from Khabarovsk to Petropavlovsk, and so we had all the gear we needed. Not quite as risky or as adventurous as our absolute first trip to Russia, but obviously back then, we're dealing with the whole, in terms of the, tourism, they were just basically getting started. So, there were a lot of glitches, and I remember some of the early groups, there were really no good hotels to put people in, so we basically stayed at people's homes, in their apartments or their flats, as they're called. So we put clients up in people's apartments, which was kind of interesting. But then again, it gave people a chance to see what Russian culture is really like, because in Russia, like so many other countries in the third world, they don't have the luxury of shipping their parents to some retirement home. So in one typical apartment, you'll find, three generations of Russians living. So it gave the American clients a chance to see, the inside of Russian culture there. It was really interesting.
Well, sure. I know we did that with some friends in Spain. And living in somebody's houses in another country is the best way to learn about the people.
Oh, absolutely.
In the country, staying in a hotel, you learn absolutely nothing usually.
Nothing, right.
talking about Kamchatka, I'm looking at the map here, and I see, like you said, it's a peninsula. I don't see a whole lot of towns on this map or cities. I see Petropavlovsk. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Petropavlovsk.
Okay, and then looks like Esso.
Esso, yep, and then north, right in the central, what they call the Central Valley.
And that's about it.
Yeah.
Now, I assume there's other little villages there, but there's not a whole lot of infrastructure there.
Yeah. Most of those are scattered along the mouth of most of the major rivers, yeah.
Now, is there a road that goes between those two cities?
Yeah, there is. In fact, some of our exploratory trips, we base out of Esso, and getting to Esso is quite an adventure. You drive up all day up the Central Valley along the Kamchatka River, and the road gets real rugged in some spots. It's not paved in a lot of areas. Beautiful drive. But, yeah, on the longer trips, you get a chance to do things like that. The promise has been in the last few years, air travel, the infrastructure, has limited most of the operators here. Since they fly just once a week, you're limited to either 1 week or 2 week trips. And most Americans opt for the 1 week trip because it's so much harder to take that much time off from work. So.
Okay, so you fly into Petropavlovsk, and then from there you said air travel. So how do you get from there to your camps, or are there camps?
All the operators, all the tourism, all the remote travel is done by helicopters. So basically you've got several hubs that the helicopter's based out of. Petropavlovsk is one, Esso is one, and then there's several north and of Esso. Kluchi is one. And in Palana, so there's only a few areas that the helicopter's based out of. So that's been basically the main kind of framework for accessing Kamchatka, is working out of the hubs that the helicopters are located out of.
Okay. And then you're flying into lodges or tent camps, or what? What's your destination look like?
There's about five operators doing business in Kamchatka. When I say operators, I want to basically elaborate that all the sport fishing operations and that are based America-based companies like myself and a fly shop and others are partnered with Russians as joint ventures. So essentially, you know, most of the business, most of the economy generated by these sport fishing tour companies stays in Kamchatka. Of all these operators, I believe every one of the operators offers a float trip option. So most of the other operators, other than myself and Paul Allred's Usual Expeditions, offer either a fixed camp or a lodge experience. Predominantly, it's more a kind of a fishing operation where you're basing out of a camp and then you're using jet boat to access some of the better parts of the rivers. And we offer exclusively float trip expeditions, and Paul Allred does as well. But the other operators offer a fixed camp and lodge experiences.
Okay, so when you run your trips, You're floating and then camping at a different site every night and moving on.
Correct.
Down the river.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's a real expedition.
Okay. What are these camps like? Are you really roughing it, or?
Well, they you know, obviously use modern gear, so they've got a certain modicum of comfort. Even the so-called tent camps, you know, have individual places for people to stay that are heated, and they have a dining tent and. It's not. Well, I wouldn't consider it roughing it. I'm obviously not five-star accommodations, but but you know, and
yeah, you live in Alaska, Renee. People think that even going to Alaska is roughing it.
Oh,
so.
I understand. Yeah, yeah.
For you, 5-star is probably a tent and a thermarest, right?
Well, absolutely. I've gotten real simple in my needs and my expectations. That's for sure.
Yeah. But, I mean, is it equivalent to a tent camp like you'd find in Alaska in the way of
Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah. Similar to any one of the tent camps that you'd find in Southwest Alaska, like say along the Nishigak or one of the other major rivers there. You know, and they use jet boats. You know, and they, you know, essentially what these operations all have evolved into, where they're like hybrid operations. So we're basically, you know, we take our expertise from, like say for myself, years of experience doing trips in Southwest Alaska, and we develop a program with the Russians, even though it's, you know, Russians are predominate and very few Americans are involved in the operation. It becomes a hybrid operation because you get them set up with all this great gear, you know, the best gear possible and all new. But yet, at the same time, they put their own unique twist to the program that only the Russians can do.
Right.
So, but yeah, no, it's totally modern, totally efficient. And one thing I might add is that the Russian people in general, all the ones I've encountered over there in the years I've been doing trips, are very resourceful, very hardworking. So, you're basically going to benefit from all that and getting an experience that, even though it may not, like I say, may not be as elaborate as, let's say, a fly-out lodge in Bristol Bay or Southeast Alaska, you know, one of those custom lodges, you're still going to have, you know, all kinds of amenities. And not the least of which I might mention is great food, because the Russians cook everything from scratch. And also a real important thing to remember is that the Mi-8 helicopter, which is like the workhorse of the fleet over there that for transporting gear and people, is an incredible machine capable. I mean, it's got, I think, like a 15,000-pound payload. So weight is not a consideration like it is, let's say, in Southwest Alaska, where you're using small float-equipped aircraft for most of your operations. So you can take anything you want in the way of gear.
Okay, now, so you're not gonna have a personal masseuse or a gourmet chef.
Probably not, like
the lodges in Alaska.
Right.
But you mentioned the food. Well, tell us a little bit about, you know, what your meals might be like on a trip, and you know what the Russian fare is all about.
Well, as I say on one of our trips, you know, we use those helicopters, and we're not shaving ounces like we are on our Alaska trips. We can literally take whatever we want, which means crates of vodka, sacks of potatoes and beets, and then we bring two girls on the river who basically function is just to cook meals from scratch. And so it always amuses me, the first night out on the river, people are just so totally blown away by the food. The girls will make, like, to start off with, they'll start off with the first course will be some borscht, homemade borscht with some of that really good Russian dark bread. And the clients are, you know, dive into it after a day on the river thinking that this is it. And I have to tell them, slow down, this is only the first course, you know. And typically the main course will involve, shish kebabs, where we take some fish, usually dali bar and char or salmon, and cook, you know, basically cook them shish kebab style over a fire, or it may be Russian blini, you know, or some form of Russian pasta, or a meat dish made with chicken. They do a lot of really good kind of ethnic dishes that are a combination of some of the elements of Mideast cooking, because some of the Russians are from different parts of Russia, like Soviet Georgia and those places. So we get some real interesting dishes out there on the river. But the point is that compared to, let's say, what I would be offering people on one of my Alaska float trips, the meals on these Russia trips just nothing like anything I could offer them in Alaska, simply because I'm dealing with a whole different set of factors over there in Alaska.
Yeah, exactly. Sounds good.
Yeah,
so
really
people aren't going to be starving, that's for
no,
sure.
No. And like I said, most folks come away from that experience with real fond memories of just how they ate and how well, you know, they were taken care of out on the river, just as much as the fishing, they remember that.
Yeah. Well, you had mentioned a few minutes ago, talked about the length of stay over there, and you said you're restricted to 1 week stays. So you have to do at least a full week, right? Is that the case?
Correct, yeah.
Okay. And then what would you recommend? Is that...
Yeah, if you can take the time, you know, the other operators, and we offer a longer trip, a two-week trip is ideal, because then you can pretty much space out everything so it's not as compressed. So you've got more time to spend fishing. It's a little more leisurely pace, and then you could include in a two-week trip like 9 days out on the river, which is plenty of time to be out on the river. I've never met anyone who wasn't satisfied with the amount of fishing they did in 9 days out on the river. And then you can offer other activities like horseback riding, visits to museums, to villages, remote villages, for, you know, cultural interaction, trips to volcano hiking. We've done volcano treks up into active volcanoes for people to experience that. So you just get a lot better glimpse of the culture and the country that way than you do with the one-week trip, which is very compressed. Essentially, on a one-week trip, you fly into, leave Anchorage very early in the morning on the flight, arrive in Russia very early, actually the next day because you cross the date line, and then you're basically flying out on the river, and then you're out there for 6 days, and then you come back in, spend a night in a hotel, and then fly back to Anchorage the next day. So it doesn't give you a chance to see much and to do much other than just the fishing.
Okay, then if you did a two-week trip, how would that pan out actually?
Well, basically, if you did our two-week expedition, exploratory expedition, you would fly in, to PK in the morning, and then we'd board one of our special buses and drive up the Central Valley, and we'd take time along the Central Valley to stop and have lunch and see some of the sites. There's some interesting attractions along that drive to Esso, and then we'd overnight in a B&B in Esso, a real interesting place on the edge of town. And Esso's a real interesting town in and by itself. It's basically a large geothermal site that people have settled around, and there's a large open-air hot water pool, and everyone heats their homes with hot water and has these incredible gardens and greenhouses. And so it's just a chance to really see a lot more of Kamchatka. And then, of course, we'd have the 9 days on the river, fly out, the next morning and come back. And after, with that, we still have a few days left. We'd do a horseback trip into the mountains to visit some hot springs or maybe do some volcano trekking before going back to PK and overnighting before the trip back to the U.S. I should mention that an option for travel to Kamchatka, a very nice option if you have a group of people, like, say, on the East Coast, is to fly through, let's say, JFK or Boston's Logan Airport or wherever to Moscow. And then from Moscow, you can get daily connections to Kamchatka. And this allows you then to tailor your trip length with daily connections. You can have a trip, of 10 or 11 days, which makes a real nice option for people who can't take 2 weeks off.
Well, that was Ed in Byfield, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Just that as... from Boston, Logan Airport, how would you get there? So he's got two choices then. Go
right. And the thing is, it's a lot cheaper to go that route, to go through Moscow, if you have a whole group there. And then another nice thing about going through Moscow, if you've never been to Russia, is on the way back or even on the way over, you could schedule 1 or 2 days. We have some people we can hook you up with to take you on a tour of Moscow, go see the Kremlin, Red Square, that kind of thing. And so that makes a real nice a bonus to a trip over.
Yeah, I think it would, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we need to take a quick break here again, Renee, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Renee more about fly fishing for giant rainbows in Kamchatka. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net or email them at pudge@womensflyfishing.net or call them at 907-274-7113. Well, you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Renee Lemires about Kamchatka, trout fishing's next frontier. If you'd like to ask Renee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to ask us a question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Renee, let's Take just a couple minutes and tell the folks about your business, what you do with Ultimate Rivers, and both in Alaska and in Russia, and just give us a brief description of the products and services you offer.
Well, thank you, Roger. You know, my main interest in doing these fishing trips has always been, you know, the river experience and the experience that you have specifically floating down from headwaters. That's always been such a turn-on for this. And the first time I ever did a float trip in Alaska, which was many years ago, I was always intrigued by just the whole, how intimate an experience you can have of an area by floating and camping down one of the rivers. So basically that's, you know, has formed the kind of the whole foundation of my program in Alaska and Russia has been doing float trip expeditions. For people who haven't done that, basically what you're doing is flying into the headwaters of one of the rivers, let's say in Southwest or wherever, and then using inflatable rafts, high-tech inflatable rafts, and then floating down, fishing your way down, and then making camps wherever you happen to be by water's edge, and floating down anywhere from 3 to 5, 7 days, and then putting out at the bottom of the rivers either by using motorboats or plane access to get back to your point of departure. And the advantages have always, been obviously you're on a river, 24/7, so you get to fish, some of the most productive times of the day, and then also you get to fish water that no one else can access as you float down from the headwater. So we basically developed that concept in Southwest Alaska over the years with the float trips we did, and then we took that concept to Russia when we first started fishing over there, and it's worked out really well. It's not, it's a niche that not everyone obviously is suited for in terms of your fly fishing clientele. You generally get younger, more adventurous guys who want to do that. Some of the older folks want to sleep in a lodge and have all the amenities. But I always try to stress the advantages of that kind of experience over, let's say, the lodge experience. You just can't compare the two in terms of what you come away with. You get a much more intimate sense of the country and the wildlife and the fishing, and then of course interacting in terms of the a Russia trip, interacting with the Russians themselves gives you a chance to learn a lot about their culture. So it's just a really unique kind of experience.
That's pretty much
what we've been about. Yeah.
And what's your website address in case people want to?
UltimateRivers.com.
UltimateRivers.com.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Good. Well, maybe we can carry on a little bit from that. I've got a question here from Captain Bob Jaspers, who actually was on our show, and we did a show with him about redfish and black drum and so forth down on eastern Florida. But he says, Renee, my dream vacation is to take an extended trip to Alaska to fish for salmon and trout, and I'm still saving up for that. My question is, what does it cost to make a trip to Russia and back, and are there any requirements such as, legal red tape, fees, taxes, passports, visas, etc.?
Yeah, it's not, obviously a trip to Kamchatka is not for the weak of heart, or it does take a certain amount of commitment in terms of money.
Platinum card?
yeah, right, no kidding. In terms of money, the fees will vary anywhere from, for 1 week trip, 1 week stay, depending on what you're doing, a float trip or staying in a lodge, anywhere from $4,000 per person to upwards close to $6,000 a week. And then you have to factor in the airfare over to Russia, which can, depending on how you go and when you buy your ticket and how you buy your ticket, can vary anywhere from $900 to over $2,000. In terms of special requirements, it's a foreign country, obviously. You'll need your U.S. passport, and you'll need a Russian tourist visa, which can be secured quite easily through some of the major travel brokers or from the operator that you book with. So, you're looking, obviously looking at a trip that is going to set you back a bit more than probably a trip anywhere else to fish in the world. So,
right, right. pretty far removed from everything, yep. And that's always
right.
Costly.
But then again, that's the appeal because you know, obviously, sure. you're not fishing something an area that gets hammered by people. So
yeah. Well, that gives people a good idea, anyways. And mm-hmm. and you said you know that it is remote and you hardly see any people, but you know you can fly into some of these places in Alaska and still meet up with a crowd nowadays. Do you pretty much have the river to yourself when you're out there on your...
Oh, yeah. It's nothing like in Alaska. I mean, I was just amazed. I was planning a trip this summer, one of my trips this summer not too long ago in Alaska. And my main concern now is contacting these other air taxi operators to see when they have groups coming in so I can sit my trip in so I'm not going to be out there in the river with other people. And that's these are rivers where 20 years ago, no one you could float and not see a single soul or even a sign of people. In Russia, Kamchatka, we don't have that problem. I mean, I know for any given week that you know I'm going to be the only of American and group of Americans on that river, so we can float down from the headwaters to do the whole entire trip and not see anyone. So that's real special.
And I suppose you can work with the other operators to make sure you don't. Stop on
well, we all know who, you know what rivers, and we respect the other guy's so-called territory. I wouldn't think of going up on a river that let's say Will Blair's fishing. And if I wanted to, I would just say, hey, Will, you know, okay, I'd like to check it out, and you know, can I just go? And you know, we trust
right.
each other and we respect each other, and there's just such a limited number of players that works, and it's really nice.
Whatever. Question here from Scott in Denver, and he wants to know what's the best time of year to catch trout, char, and other species. And he's not looking only to catch trout when he goes there, which is, of course, one of the big attractions there. So when's the best time of year if you want to have a large variety of species?
That's a good question. You know, the season there is very similar to Alaska. Develops a little bit differently because of the fact that it's got usually more snowpack and further south. Generally, some really good fishing from late June on. Early in the season, really good, fantastic dry fly fishing. The salmon settle into the spawning sometime in August usually, a little bit later than they do in Alaska. And then from mid-August on, really good fishing. The best time for big fish... late is probably middle September in the fall when the fish have been feeding all summer and they're very prime and very extremely the best condition of the year.
And when you're saying big fish, you're talking about big rainbows specifically.
Big rainbows, yeah. And in terms of other species, Kamchatka, you know, has been developed primarily as a rainbow trout destination, but has some really good salmon fishing as well and excellent, outrageous char fishing too. And the char are taken, you know, at the same time the rainbows are taken. In fact, they're basically taken in far greater numbers than even the rainbows in some locations. One of the things about salmon fishing is the salmon fishing in Alaska and Russia along the coast there is always best near the mouth of the rivers. And typically when you're doing fishing rainbow trout, you're going to be fishing up away from the coast. So... the areas that you'll fish for rainbows aren't necessarily the best areas to target salmon. So most of the salmon taken are taken incidentally by the trout fishermen. And
when you're talking,
I
was going to say when you're talking big rainbows or big char dollies, what is a big rainbow?
For Russia, big rainbow. You know, I consider big rainbow anything over 24 inches. Even for Alaska, that's pretty much my yardstick. A nice rainbow over 20, but a big one over 24. And typically in Kamchatka, the average size of the trout is a little bit bigger than in Alaska. And the reason for that is several factors. One is that the streams there are, you know, they have a longer growing season, more months where the trout are feeding, and you have a richer ecosystem, a lot more insects for the trout to feed on. And another interesting factor is they did a lot of studies on the west coast of Kamchatka, the rivers there. They were as part of the steelhead research. Found that there are different life history variations. Some of the rainbows live in the stream year-round like they do in Alaska, and some of them go out into the estuaries for certain times of the year, and some of them obviously go out to sea like steelhead. So you have different life history variations. So the whole upshot of all that is that the trout are run bigger in Kamchatka than they do in Alaska.
Okay. And you kind of just answered this part of this question. Maybe you can elaborate on it. Richard in Virginia, Richard Barnett, he wanted to know if rainbows are ocean to stream or out of lakes chasing salmon eggs and flesh like in Alaska. So
right.
It sounds like you have a...
there's a different mix. In Alaska, you don't have that variation. There are some, you know, I remember quite a few times in the rivers of Bristol Bay specifically, you do get, there hasn't been the studies on movement that there have been in Russia. And I do know that on some of the rivers like the Nishigak and the Togiak, some of these other rivers, Kinnekuk, I have caught rainbows that have been out in estuaries because they have sea lice on them. So I think you get some of those variations as well, but you don't get the degree of variation. I was reading a study that was done on one of the rivers in western Kamchatka. They found six different life history variations on the rainbow trout there. So they definitely have a lot more options in terms of their life history capability and also feeding, because you don't, in Alaska, most of the trout are primarily keyed on the salmon. They're feeding on smolt in the spring. They're feeding on salmon eggs and decaying salmon and flesh later on in the summer and fall. So you've got a lot more possibilities for them to get nutrients than they do in Alaska.
Right. Well, do the rainbows do a similar thing like in Alaska? I know they'll come out of the lakes during a salmon spawn and
right.
actually go into the streams to feed on the eggs and flesh and so forth.
Right. But as I said, in Kamchatka, you have a limited number of lake and river systems. The thing that's always amazed me about Kamchatka is comparing some of the rivers that we do routinely over there, we get rainbows that these are just closed systems, no lakes, that achieve the same size as they do in the lake and river systems in Alaska, where you know, like say the Iliamna or Naknek system, where these are like, they're like steelhead. These fish are going out in these gigantic lakes most of the year, and they come back into the tributary streams to spawn or to eat on, you know, salmon roe. But in Kamchatka, you have fish that achieve the same size just by living in these streams and going out to sea and stuff. So it's a really, really interesting variation and allows, you know, for some really phenomenal fishing and streams that you wouldn't think hold that big fish, you know.
Hmm, interesting. Now, in looking at the map of Kamchatka again, I noticed several rivers on the west coast there, and then you've got the Kamchatka River kind of running up the center. Is that primarily where your fishing is, on those west coast rivers?
Most of the programs are on the southern or central west coast. And actually, it's probably more, let me backtrack, it's probably evenly divided. Two of the operators feature rivers on the east coast, but and then also they also feature some rivers on the west coast. So it's kind of even divided, but most of it obviously is southern Kamchatka and central Kamchatka. Very little in northern Kamchatka, simply because it's removed from the major hubs, and so it's more expensive and more time to get up there. And so, most of the area that we fish is all southern and central Kamchatka.
Now, you talk a lot about rainbow trout in Kamchatka, and it seems to be known for that more so than the salmon is. Obviously, the size you just indicated is a big factor in the rainbows there, but is the salmon fishery, if a person wanted to go there for salmon, would you consider that worthwhile, or are you just as good in Alaska?
It depends on what species you're talking about. I would definitely encourage, the Russians are developing a lot of salmon fishing programs along the rivers there in the last few years, and I've seen some really interesting results on some of the rivers there. They've gotten some really good fishing. I would recommend, like say for king salmon, to explore. There are several possibilities. some of the camps, the fly shops had some exploratory trips on some of the lower rivers. One of the rivers that we do for float trips, they have a camp on the mouth for king salmon fishing. Some really good results. Like smaller rivers, though, not large runs, but the conditions are perfect for fly fishing. Now for silver salmon, I just haven't seen anything in terms of the. It's not just the numbers of fish, but also the size of the fish. The silver salmon I've seen in Kamchatka, at least southern Kamchatka, don't compare in size to some of the bigger silvers of, like, say, Kodiak, southwest Alaska, or southeast. And also in terms of numbers, I think Alaska, at least from what I've seen, has better silver salmon fishing. Of course, if you want to catch an exotic like cherry salmon, they have cherry salmon found along the west side of Kamchatka, so that's a real unique species to go over there and fish. You can fish those the same time you fish kings. So I guess, yeah, as Alaska becomes more and more crowded, and I think we're going to see more opportunities open up for dyed-in-wool salmon anglers to try some new and virtually unfished streams for salmon fishing.
We have a question from Larry in New Mexico, and he wants to know what has become of the steelhead fishing program in Kamchatka. He said he was scheduled to go a few years ago, but permits were canceled, and he says he's not seen anything since. Is there a poaching problem in Kamchatka during the steelhead season, or what's the real story there?
Well, as far as steelhead goes, to understand what's going on over there, need a little history here. They were basically listed in the Soviet Red Book as an endangered species. That's their equivalent of our endangered species list. This was back in a time before any real data had been accumulated from any research, just initial observations. And so once they were on this threatened or endangered list, then they were pretty much off limits for most people to mess with. And so even though as operators started fishing the west coast streams, they discovered some really good steelhead fishing, the only way they could offer legitimate programs was as part of a research program that was done by the Wild Salmon Center under some joint permit from Moscow University. And so essentially what these programs developed into were 1 and 2 week trips where fishermen would go over and they would catch steelhead in conjunction with these biologists who were tagging and measuring these fish and taking other data. And so that went on for 10 years. And they accumulated a lot of data. In fact, some of the information that I was talking about earlier came from those steelhead research programs. At the end of the 10-year program, their permits were up, and as of yet, I have not heard that the government is wanting to renew that kind of program for various reasons. So right now, as far as I know, that steelhead program is pretty much been put on hold. So I don't know I know there's a lot of pressure to open that program up simply because there's money to be made there. But
right
now, they had some bad experiences in terms of my understanding, and this may not be entirely correct, but my understanding is that there were some money problems there. They had money that was supposed to be appropriated to different causes that there were some accounting problems.
Accounting errors.
That got lost. were supposed to be. So the Russians weren't too happy about that. So.
Yeah. Well, on hold for now, anyways.
Yeah, and also the poaching. Poaching is a significant problem over there, not just with steelhead, but also rainbow trout and salmon. It's a real serious problem because it's just like in so many other areas in the third world. You don't have any economies other than that come from poaching. I mean, there's no way.
Yeah.
You provide economic opportunity and make it worthwhile for people to see these different species as a benefit, not as something to be harvested. Just
right.
In other words, you have to make it worthwhile to keep these things alive rather than killing them. So.
Yeah, and that's an educational process.
Economic, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a break here, but when we return, Renee will be answering more of your questions about fly fishing in Russia. Attention fly fishers, are you aware of the proposed pebble mining project in southwest Alaska? This enormous open pit would generate as much as 3 billion tons of waste in a seismic area with some of the most important trout and Pacific salmon fisheries in all of Alaska, or for the world, for that matter. The well-being of Lake Iliamna and the entire Bristol Bay area waters may be at stake. If you're not already acquainted with this, do acquaint yourself, and you can make a difference. The ramifications reach far beyond fly fishing. Go to www.sportsmansalliance, and then that's the number 4ak.org, sportsmansalliance4ak.org, to learn more about this and to contribute. And they've actually got an online auction going right now on eBay of a lot of services, trips, products, accessories, and so forth that you can bid on. And, of course, your money will help support the protection of this area in Alaska, which is very important. So get involved, be proactive, and help protect our environment and the future of fly fishing. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Renee Lamarez about Kamchatka, trout fishing's next frontier. If you'd like to ask Renee a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question, and then we'll receive your question immediately. We'll try to answer as many of them as, on the show as possible tonight. Well, Renee, let's talk more about fishing. We've got a question from Richard in Virginia. He wants to know, is the fishing there primarily streamer, nymph, surface fly? And tell us a bit about the equipment that you would need, rod, line, tippet, and so forth.
Yeah, obviously depending on the time of the year that you fish over there and the kind of stream conditions, but varies. A lot of dry fly action there, a lot of insect hatches. Generally during the hottest part of the season, June and July, but you can have insect hatches even in September. I've been on many trips in the fall when you do encounter hatches, and feeding can become quite exclusive on those hatches. So you'll need dry flies, floating lines. These fish are not leader shy, and this is not, you know, compared to other locations like New Zealand and Tasmania and the western streams in the American West. This is not real technical fishing. These are dumb rainbows and dollies. So you're not going to need fluorocarbon leaders, long fluorocarbon leaders. A lot of there's quite a bit of obviously. Dead drifting of egg and flesh patterns, and a significant amount of nymphing goes on. For most of the stream fishing that we do, I recommend people bring a floating line and then a short sink tip. In terms of rods, 6 and 7 weights, occasional use for an 8 weight if you're down you're fishing a larger river down near the mouth. Or obviously for steelhead fishing, if you were going to encounter steelhead, you'd want an 8. In fact, all the operators, once you book with them, will provide you a very detailed personal equipment list and fishing gear list. So if you have any questions, they will certainly be able to give you detailed answers to help you dial in your gear and your equipment. Tippet size... this is obviously a personal preference. I've fished Alaska a lot. I just basically like using one tippet throughout the trip, no matter what I encounter in terms of stream conditions or fish. So I use like an 8-pound, 8 to 12-pound tippet. But that's pretty much it. Like I said, you know, you'll be working with your operator once you book a trip over there. They'll give you a real good idea of what equipment you need for the particular waters you'll be fishing in and the time of year you'll be over there.
But nothing real fancy, it doesn't sound.
Nothing
like
fancy, no. These are not, like I said, it's not a real technical fisher at all.
And now Tony Cook in Grand Rapids, Michigan, wanted to know the smallest rod and reel size to bring. So
obviously, you know, that's a personal thing. I've had guys go over there with, you know, 5 weight, living a little dangerously. But in the headwaters, in the first few days, you can get away with a 5. You know, you hook a nice fish in bigger water, and you're going to be in trouble. But some guys like that kind of thrill. So.
But I guess as fly fishers, we also have to consider the fish, too. And the lighter you go,
the more
wear and tear
right.
you put on that fish.
Right, right.
Which is, I think, we all need to think about.
Right.
For our own enjoyment, it's not necessarily the best solution for the
right,
fish.
Especially with rainbows. Rainbows fight so hard, they typically will just get so exhausted they have a hard time reviving. So,
Well, one thing I meant to ask earlier, but about the guides over there, are the guides familiar with fly fishing?
Most of them are.
It, no?
Yeah. We've been training them. They've become, you know, over the years, you know, you get some people who have been, you know, who've been with you from the start and becoming quite accomplished as fly fishermen. Some of the newer guides, you know, don't have the expertise or familiarity. But one thing about the Russians, as I said earlier, was that they're resourceful, hardworking, and just will do anything to please a client. I've had these guys row rafts upstream, okay, against the current, loaded rafts, and just literally do anything to try to retrieve a fly that's hung up on bottom or something. I mean, these guys will do anything. They're just what they may lack in knowledge, will make up for, and just basically a dedication to provide you with. And they all speak enough English to where you can communicate with them. So, it's real easy to just basically direct them to do and get what you need out of any particular stretch of water, you know, in terms of drifting or whatever. So,
what's the ratio of guides to fishermen?
It's generally very good. Obviously, on the float trip, it's a lot higher than you would have on a fixed camp operation. We generally run one guide for every two clients or even more, because we do bring some extra guides along to help around the camp and do some cooking. So generally, it's a lot higher than you would encounter in a similar operation in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And do they have equipment, spare rods, reels, line?
Very limited. You know, the thing that people need to understand, and this is made adequately, abundantly clear, most of the literature, prep literature that is provided by operators, basically warns you that, you know, there's no fly shops over there. Nobody has, you know, the Russians do have gear, but it might, you know, obviously they're of a lot more limited means than American guides, so they may not have really good gear to replace whatever you break. So you need to bring some spare gear along, and all the flies and all the accessory material that's needed, you need to take that with you.
Okay. Well, speaking of flies, Ed in Byfield, Massachusetts, wants to know what fly patterns are effective, and so, you know, what can you bring, and are they similar to North America or Alaska?
Very similar to what we use in Alaska, egg and flesh patterns, identical patterns. There's a few spin-offs. You know, I have these little favorites that I've whipped up, you know, Kamchatka specials and all this stuff, but it's basic principles, it's same principle, attractor, flesh patterns, forage patterns, you know, leech, sculpins, that kind of thing, and then dry flies, very similar to the patterns that you would use on Western rivers, caddis patterns, Adams, irresistible stimulators. They have very, very similar hatches to what you would find on Western rivers, stone flies, mayflies, caddis flies, gnats.
Sounds like I got to bring everything.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's very similar to what you would have in Alaska. And also, of course, I must mention that the mouse, the deer hair mouse, is a very, very popular and productive pattern over there, even more so than in Alaska for some reason. So you'd want to have your assortment of little meeses that you bring over there.
But we had a question specifically about that from Eduardo.
Oh, okay, good.
All places, Argentina. And
yeah.
You want to know, do you fish with mouse patterns? What's the most effective pattern?
Yeah,
He's asking this because he hears it's very common to fish for rainbow trout with mice.
You know, it's down where he's from, they fish for a big brown at night. But, you know, in Alaska and Russia, in Kamchatka, the rainbows will hit these things in broad daylight. It's really spectacular, too, to take, you know, especially in clear water when you can see it coming. And basically, you know, obviously there's resident rodent populations. They're cyclical in nature. Some years they're real abundant. And the years they're real abundant, you can have spectacular fishing with a mouse pattern. Even during the height of the salmon spawning, the rainbows will come up and whack the mouse. We've been on trips during those times of rodent abundance where that's all the guys fish the whole entire trip. because it's just such a hoot to fish with, you know, these mouse
traps. I bet you that's exciting to see them come up.
Oh, it really is. Yeah. And these fish are not sophisticated, so they'll come up and keep hitting it until you hook them, so it's really amazing. Yeah. They'll chase
like
it literally right beneath your feet, you know, and they'll whack it.
I guess it's a nice meal for them.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
lots
a lot
of protein.
Yeah. So if a person, you said you need to bring everything. So if a person's going to tie some flies to go over there, I guess one would be get some of the books that have a lot of the patterns in for Alaska and start there. And then, like you said, check with the operators for the time of year, and I guess that'll determine what kind of other patterns, such as mayfly, midge.
Yeah, they will give you a real good pattern list, and all the operators have their little favorites that they like to feature. Bees can be really effective over there too. You know, there is a time, like I said, and by mid-August, the salmon settle down into, you know, their spawning beds, and that can be just as productive over there fishing as you would encounter in Southwest Alaska. So, bees.
And what about bringing along materials to tie flies over there? Is that?
That's a great idea, but you know, in reality, you know, you get around the campfire at night after dinner, start drinking vodka and beer and stuff, and you know, I've seen guys bring a lot of stuff that never even gets used, so it's a great concept, but I think it's, yeah, you know.
That vodka catches up to you rather quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so do a lot of tying before you go. That's
I would,
sure.
Yeah, I would recommend having everything done before you go over there.
Okay. What about the fishing as far as strategies? You said it's pretty simple over there, not highly technical, but are you primarily, you said you're drifting, you know, doing the expedition, you're drifting down, but do you actually drift fishing from the boat, or is it mainly wading?
It's mainly wade and cast fishing. On our trips, we use the boat for just conveying the gear down, and you'll come to an occasional spot, you know, deep water or rapids or something that you want to get through, and we'll, you know, you just get the guys in the boat and you know, float over that. But there's no point. My philosophy is there is no point floating over good water that can be fished by weight and cast.
You gain no advantage.
No, none. Because basically, you're floating over. You're blowing through all this good water. So
yeah,
you know, I first thing I'll do is I just put the guys out and then they wade and cast and they're able to enjoy it a lot more that way, and you don't miss all the fish like you would floating through.
Yeah, Mike Rossi in Decatur, Georgia want to know about this wading and drifting. Is there he specifically asked about access to big fish. Are most of the fish you're fishing to in the larger class, or are you picking up 12 inches as well there, or what?
No, you don't catch 12 inches in Kamchatka. Very seldom. I'm serious. There's no small.
They go from small to 20 inches.
It does appear
right?
That way. In fact, some of the first trips we did over there, we marveled at the total lack of small fish. The only way I can explain that is when you're fishing a virgin stream situation, there's a real hierarchy that develops when you're the first boat down a river, you know, that's never been fished before, and you pull over in a spot, you know, like a hole or a confluence or something, you know, the first guys out of the boat I can predict are going to get these honkers because, you know, these fish, there's a hierarchy that they segregate into where the, you know, the biggest fish are positioned in the best possible feeding positions in any particular stretch of water. And they're real territorial, real competitive. So I think what it comes down to is that these smaller little, we call them dinks, just get totally excluded from these areas. And like I said, the first few trips we did over there, we just marveled at the fact that, you know, we were catching all these, you know, the average size was like 24 inches. We're the small fish. But I think that in a virgin stream condition and as rich a streams as they are over there, that the smaller fish is just totally excluded. And so they're found in just, you know, small little creeks and small periphery areas where there's no competition from bigger fish for food. So.
Well, that's good for us as fly fishers,
yeah.
Huh?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wondered that, you know, there's some other parts of the world that are like that, and I guess that is just the hierarchy. You know, even up, like, say, the Bighorn River and in Montana, you tend to just catch larger fish. You
right,
don't catch
right.
these 8-inchers or 9-inchers.
Yep.
You wonder, where the heck are they? And
yep.
they're hiding, I guess, from the bigger fish.
Yeah, oh, they are.
yeah. Are there any, again, you said things are simple up there, but are there any strategies or techniques that are, specific to Kamchatka that you would use, there as opposed to some
No, not really. In terms
okay.
of the kinds of fishing and the techniques and the strategy, you'd be using all those techniques and strategies at some time in Alaska, only the mix is a lot more it's different in Kamchatka, and it's weighted a lot more differently toward, like, say, the dry fly action, which, for instance, in Kamchatka, you'll get hatches where you'll be fishing where the fish in certain instances will feed exclusively on dries, even the dollies. And I've never seen that in Alaska. The dolly is the most omnivorous, most ubiquitous fish in all the state. And typically in Alaska, no self-respecting dolly is going to pass up a well-presented attractor or streamer. Whereas in Kamchatka, you'll get situations where these insect hatches arise and the fish feed exclusively on tiny little gnats or midges to the point where you can't catch a dolly any other way in these areas, which is really unusual. And then other times you'll get on spawning beds, you'll have the trout and the char feeding on obviously the salmon roe, but then on the periphery you might get some insect activity, and there's a few of the big trout just feeding on hatches. So it's a little bit different, the kinds of situations you find over there. But in terms of the strategies and the presentation, you use all those things at certain times of year, certain places in Alaska as well. So there's nothing unique or exotic. And the mouse fishing is the same thing. I mean, we've had some really good mouse fishing in Alaska, although not as good as in Russia. But so there's nothing real unique to any of the fishing there.
But it sounds like for the dry fly fishers, there's a lot of activity and possibilities there. But
oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
it's some of the best dry fly fishing going, I think.
Wow, that sounds exciting. Nothing
yeah.
like a 24-inch rainbow on a coming up to sip a dry fly.
No kidding. Yeah, especially in clear water like that. It's just real
exciting. Yeah, you can see them coming, I suppose, many times. Yeah. Yeah, that's when you have to hold back before you set that hook.
Right.
I get too excited, yeah. Well, Renee, unfortunately, we're time to wrap things up here. We've kind of run out of time. When we return, we're going to give away those 3-year memberships to the Federation of Fly Fishers and the 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine and also that copy of your book. So everybody stay tuned to see if you win. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website, www.familyties.com. That's family and then T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Well, just as a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under Renee's description there where it says, what did you think of the show? Just click on the link and leave your comments. Now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners for these drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show because we're always giving away some great, great prizes. Now, if you're the lucky winner tonight, we'll contact you after the show, provide you with the information on how to receive your gift. So first, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. And to learn more about the FFF, go to www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org, and you can learn more about the Federation of Fly Fishers. Well, we'll press our magic button here, and we have a winner, John Campello. John Campello in New Jersey. So, John, you get a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, which I'm sure you'll enjoy. It's always a great thing and a great organization to support. And now we'll give away that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine, which if you want to learn more about that publication, you can go to www.flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com. They're out of Calgary, Canada. Produce a beautifully illustrated, photographically illustrated magazine that has a lot of how-to articles on it and is very, very good read. And the winner for that is Mike Rossi, who Mike had asked a question tonight. Mike Rossi in Georgia. So he's the winner of that one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So congratulations to the two of you. And now we'll give away a copy of Renee's book, Alaska Fishing, and it's the ultimate guide to the ultimate cold water sport fishing destination. And I know Renee has put a lot of work into this book. It's very comprehensive, covers every fish, every sport fish that I know of in Alaska and probably some I didn't know of, but a great read as well and a great research tool. And for this, we have to ask a question of our group, and tonight we'll make this real easy. Our question will be, what is the primary sport fish that you would go to Kamchatka to fish for? And Renee, I just keep pressing the button that people have to submit their answers, and over the internet here, and we're checking for people to submit their answers. And I've got Chris from Des Moines, Iowa, and Chris says rainbow trout. So I think that's the right answer, is it not, Renee?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we'll give that to Chris as the ultimate sport fish in Kamchatka would be the rainbow trout, and Chris will win that book. And Chris, Renee will be sending you that book directly from Alaska, so it might have a few mosquitoes in between the pages, but it'd still be a great read. So congratulations, Chris, and Renee, thanks so much for offering a book on our show. We really appreciate that. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, my pleasure, Roger. Really was. Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I always enjoy talking with you. I got to get up there and go fishing with you one of these times.
Yeah, no kidding. Really.
So I'd like to come back there since I grew up there in Alaska anyways, and it's always a pleasure to go back there. But thanks again, and like I said, folks, if you want to listen in on Renee's other show on Timon, that's also a great listen, and learn more about fly fishing in Russia, which I'm sure you all enjoy. Well, our next broadcast will be on June 4th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and on that show we'll be interviewing Ken Hanley, and our topic for that show will be fly fishing for largemouth bass. Hooking up with largemouth bass is exciting and definitely splashy, and Ken will tell you exactly how to get them on the fly using special techniques and hot fly patterns. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, and Royal Gorge Anglers for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115. Extension 2. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you at that time. Don't forget to visit our website, askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you won't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.